on that.
All right. So the question is, do you people have comments on the stuff that you've just been reading in my chapter or in any of the links that I had a link to or anything else you can think of that you'd like to talk about other biotech? Yes?
I'm not sure how much you touched on it in the chapter, but like, what is supposed to be so bad about like genetically modified food? Because when I go to the grocery store and I look at like fruits and vegetables, they're small or shriveled up.
There are two separate issues. One of them is organic versus non-organic. Almost none of the non-organics is genetically modified either, except for a few particular crops. I regard the label organic as just silly, because the only inorganic food I know of is salt. All right? Organic describes a family of chemical compounds made largely out of carbon and essentially everything alive, including, you know, genetically modified corn, is organic in that sense. So the argument for organic stuff is that what the label really means is grown using little pesticides and various farming techniques, which some people think result in either tastier or healthier food. I'm not clear to me it's true, but the genetically modified food, there, I don't think there are any good arguments against it. One of the reasons people are suspicious is that people are conservative. That in the literal sense, not the political sense. That is, people say, look, we know what all the regular stuff on the shelf is like. We've been eating it for 100 years. Who knows? This is different. Maybe it's bad for us. But in terms of how it comes about, you know, everything, essentially all food products we eat are the result of human intervention over very long periods of time. That, the estimate I quote in the chapter for maize, what we call corn, the corn in Europe covers all grains, essentially. And maize is estimated to have taken about 8,000 years of selective breeding. Some of that selective breeding may have been unintentional. The one explanation of where you get the food grains is that you have hunter-gatherers. They go out and they find the grass that has the biggest seeds, essentially, because that's what they're going to eat. And they harvest that, take it back to their camp, eat it. Some of the seeds get spilled in the process. Those grow up. Next time they come by, they get the biggest and so forth. So you might have an unintentional selection effect. But large parts of it have been intentional. That people, you know, deliberately for a long time saw that some plants have better food on them than others, and so those are the ones you plant. And as I commented in the chapter, cloning is a technology that we've been using for several thousand years in agriculture, because you have probably never eaten an apple that did not come from a clone tree. Right, ordinary apples do not grow true to seed, and an apple tree grown from seed is unlikely to produce apples you would want to eat. They will still be apples, but not. So the standard technology for apples and many other things is grafting. Grafting is cloning, because what are you doing? You're taking a cutting from one tree, grafting it onto another, and everything beyond the graft is now genetically the original tree, so of course you take it from a good tree. I think there are better arguments for saying that genetic engineering is a bad idea. I don't think there are any that I find convincing. But that's separate from whether it's bad to eat it, right? I mean, there is the argument which says that some forms of genetic engineering, well, one of the standard ones, one of the ones which is not logically wrong as far as I can tell, is the superweed problem. And the argument is, suppose the genetic engineering is to make my crop resistant to herbicides, which is one of the major early ones, Roundup Ready and Roundup. That basically you have an herbicide which has got lots of desirable characteristics, mainly it's not bad for humans, kills plants, so you have a genetically modified version of soybeans, which is modified not to be killed by Roundup. Great, you plant the modified version of the soybean, you spray things with Roundup, you kill the weeds, life's easy. The only problem with that, well, not the only, but the only problem that seems to be a serious one, is that your crops are ultimately derived from wild plants, some of which are weeds. So suppose we're doing it not with soybeans, but with sugar beets. There are weed beets, beet varieties that are weeds and are a nuisance. They might be cross-fertile with your sugar beets. Your sugar beets have the genes that make them resistant to Roundup. Some of that pollen might transplant those genes into the weed beets. We now have weeds that are resistant to the herbicide that's supposed to kill weeds. So that is certainly a logically possible problem. I've seen the claim fairly recently. I think I was doing a Google search that weeds resistant to Roundup seem to have increased as a result of the use of the genetically modified crops. The claim didn't say what the evidence was, because of course the other thing that's happening, quite aside from genetically modifying, is if you keep spraying Roundup on your crops to kill the weeds, whichever weeds are most resistant to Roundup are most likely to survive. So you're creating evolutionary pressure to generate, as it were, natural Roundup-resistant weeds. So how they separated those, I don't know. But maybe what they did was to look at how common they were in areas where that you were or weren't growing crops that were Roundup-resistant. So that's one possible argument, and I think it's probably the strongest argument that I can see. Other than that, the other main argument which seems to me has certain rather serious problems, is that this puts them at the mercy of the seed companies, because the seed company patents its genetically modified plant, and then you have to buy your seeds from them, whereas in the good old days you could just use the seeds from your own plants. Trouble with that is that hybrid crops have been in common use for a long time, and hybrid crops also don't grow true to seed, not because of patent protection, but because you get them by crossing two specific things, and so when you cross two with a hybrid, you get something else that is a different variety of the same species. And somehow, you know, farmers have managed to live with the fact they have to buy seeds every year instead of planting their own stuff. And, of course, even if you have genetically engineered crops, you don't have to grow them, so if you really care a lot about being able to replant from your own seed, you could still do it. So that doesn't seem to be a very strong argument. One of my students a few years ago did a paper, I've got a link to it, I think, somewhere on the webpage, stuff that I gave you people, did a rather fun paper, which purports to be a story like 40 years in the future, where somebody has transplanted some human genes to tomatoes for some reason or other. And the critics are calling them, the term is, but are basically implying that it's cannibalism to eat them, and are telling stories about hands appearing, growing out of the tomatoes, and so forth. And she's raising the legal questions. Does the company producing the tomatoes have a legal case against the people who are making false claims about their tomatoes? And that was reasonably entertaining. I'm now not remembering what the term was that she had them giving, the people defaming. So I don't see much of an argument against eating genetically engineered crops. There is an argument for so-called organic food in the sense that some pesticides might in fact have unknown serious negative effects on people, and therefore if you can do without the pesticides. But of course genetic engineering is one way of doing without pesticides, because one of the things that has been successful is transplanting the BT gene, which makes plants generate their own pesticide of a form which affects insects and not much else, including not us apparently. And also, of course, you don't need to use nearly as much of the insecticide if you're generating it inside the plant, and therefore it's exactly where you want it instead of most of it being on the ground. I'm skeptical about the organic foods, but not on the grounds that it's an absurd claim, except for the term organic. But I don't see any real argument against eating genetically modified food, and I can see some arguments, though I don't find them very persuasive, against growing genetically modified food.
I guess I kind of got mixed up with genetically modified pesticides.
Yeah, they're different issues. And in fact, if anything, the genetically modified is less likely to have pesticides, because one of the more successful genetic modification has been the BT gene, which they put into a variety of crops in order they don't need pesticides, basically. But other things that struck people about the issue or the chapter or anything else? Let me start with what seems to me to be one of the general issues that lies behind a good deal of sort of thinking about biotech and genetic modification, which is the argument that I think of as you can't compete with evolution. All right, I'm not going to claim the argument is right, but it's interesting to see what its limitations are. So the argument basically goes, look, this genetic engineering is supposed to take a plant and make it better. But evolution has been spending hundreds of billions of years making plants better. It's a much more sophisticated technology than ours is. It's true, it's rather slow, but, we can't genetically engineer a mouse, and there are mice running around, so obviously evolution could, and similarly for a whole bunch of other things. So from that standpoint, the argument then is, how can we expect to do better in modifying things? And a different version of the argument is to say, we really don't have to worry about biological warfare, because look, how could you expect Al-Qaeda to do as good a job of making a lethal disease as Mother Nature does of making lethal diseases? We've survived all them, so we're safe. And the question is, what's wrong with that argument? And I think there are three different things wrong with that argument in different contexts. And the first argument has to do with the limitations of evolution. Because evolution moves by continuous process. That is to say, if you imagine an evolutionary change that requires that you change 23 different characteristics of an organism, and with 22 it won't work, that would be extraordinarily unlikely. All right, mutation is random. It's likely enough that sort of any single change that could happen genetically would happen, but you're not going to get 23 of them carefully coordinated by chance. So that means that the way evolution works in process, in practice, is you get one small change which slightly improves something relevant to reproductive success, then another, then another, then another. And the sort of poster child for that point is the bad design of the human eye. Anybody know that? You people realize that you are all going around with negligently designed eyes. So am I, as it happens. Your retina has a layer of cells that sense light. If you were designing an eye, which side of the retina would you put that layer of cells? The light's coming from here. Here is the retina. Do you put the light-sensing cells here or here?
On the back.
Why do you put it on the back?
So that some sort of aperture could let in.
The aperture's up here.
Yeah,
so the lens up here. I'm talking about the retina, not the eye.
Okay.
You put it on the front surface or the back surface of the retina?
Surface closest to the light.
That would be a great idea. Why don't they do it that way? All right. And the answer, apparently, is that it starts out very thin, at which point it doesn't matter. And because it's moving by continuous changes, by the time the retina has evolved to be thick enough so that you lose some sensitivity by putting it on the back side, which is where ours are, instead of the front side, it would now require a big discontinuous change to turn the thing inside out. Feel jealous of the octopus and the squid. They got it right. Apparently, the evidence is that the eye has evolved multiple times in different species independently. So that the reason we have eyes in and what's the general term for that family of things anyway? That's a little bigger, I think, than a family, isn't it? But yeah.
Okay.
But yes, I don't think mollusks in general have eyes, but mollusca, I think they're mollusca, but I'm not sure. But anyway, cephalopod, that's it, cephalopod. Cephalopods apparently evolved their eyes separately, and by chance they got that one right. So what does that tell us? Suppose you're a human engineer. It may occur to you that simply flipping the retina is a really simple change. It might be a change that can't be made by changing one gene. So if you think about it, human genetic engineers and nanotech engineers, which we'll get to in a little while, are also mostly working by continuous changes. Right? If you think about, let us say, a Boeing 747, it wasn't designed by somebody who started with the Wright Brothers airplane. All right. What happens is that there is a sequence of mostly fairly small changes. Once in a while, one pretty big change, like going to jet engines. But even there, all you're changing is the engine, right? The wing is still the same, and then presumably people say, but since we've got this kind of an engine, how does that change the rest of what we do? So I think both engineering and evolution work by continuous changes, but they're different maps. That is to say, the same change that seems like a simple change to a human, like turning something inside out, may be a multi-gene, maybe a change that would require multiple genetic changes for the organism to do, in which case the human engineer could do it and the organism wouldn't. So one reason why the argument isn't right is that even if evolution has better tools than we do,
the set of things it can produce isn't the same as the set of things we can produce, and the set of things we can produce, especially if we free ride on evolution for 98% of the job, which is what we're doing in all of this stuff, might contain some things that were improved and some that didn't. For example, if I take the BT case, one of the reasons why you might have BT soybeans that didn't arise through nature is that we didn't, that the BT gene was transplanted from an entirely unrelated organism. There's some evidence that transgenic stuff sometimes happens in nature via viruses picking up genes from one thing and dumping them in another, but at least most evolution is by mutation of existing genes. Of course, the BT gives a second reason. Why is it that evolution hasn't produced all by itself Roundup resistant weeds? Your evolution. What's your excuse for not having made these weeds resistant to the pesticide?
Roundup hasn't been around long enough.
That's right. Evolution is slow, and Roundup is a new feature of the environment. Right. So there might be things where, even though evolution is much more powerful than our technology, it is also much slower, and therefore we can look around and say, huh, I know that these soybeans need to be resistant to Roundup because we're about to dump a bunch of it on them. So let's see if we can figure out a change. And probably in that case, my guess is that if we keep dumping Roundup on weeds for 100,000 years, I predict we'll get Roundup resistant weeds. Less than 100,000 years, probably. So that's it. The third reason is the one which is disturbing because it explains why we might in fact have tailored diseases that would kill us. And that's the fact that diseases don't want to kill us. Right? If you think about it, every lethal disease is a mistake. What is a disease? It's a parasite. What are you? You are a host. What is a parasite's view of its host? Live long and prosper. All right? The longer you stay alive, the longer the parasites that are in you, inside you, are going to stay alive and be able to reproduce and come out when you sneeze and stuff like that, and spread elsewhere. So, typically, lethal diseases are new diseases. A lethal disease either is a new mutation, or it's a disease that has just jumped to a human population that's not resistant to it, having developed in the human population that after a while was, or it's a disease that just jumped species from a different species. So that for the disease to survive for very long, it's got to have a population where it doesn't kill its hosts. Slight mistake, but we leave it there for the moment. And therefore, if it's in a population where it does kill the hosts, either it's a new population, new species, or a new population within one species, or alternatively, it's a new disease. The exception to my doesn't kill the hosts is if you have a sufficiently dense population of hosts, let us say New York City, you can have a disease which kills people, and as long as it doesn't do it too fast, it doesn't kill all of them, enough survive to keep the disease going, and eventually the ones who are left are resistant to the disease. And there's an interesting old book, I don't know the modern literature on this, called Plagues and Peoples by a historian. Have you read it?
No, I was wondering when I read this part, if you read that book, Guns, Germs, and Steel.
I read the beginning of it, and I probably should read the rest of it. Parts of it irritate me, and parts of it don't, but it's an interesting book. Yes. One of the things that discourages me from reading it is that I read something he wrote about something I knew something about, and it was terrible.
Oh, okay.
And that always discourages me. But he certainly made some very interesting points at the beginning. But in any case, Plagues and Peoples argues that there is an automatic biological warfare in favor of civilized people. And civilization, for this purpose, has a very specific meaning. It doesn't mean that you write great literature. It means you live in cities. So if you have a population that lives in cities and a lethal disease appears, the lethal disease, while killing off lots of people, there are enough people left because with a big population, some people are naturally resistant, so that after a while, all the people in that population are resistant and the disease is still there. It's just not lethal anymore. You now have a sailor get shipwrecked on the North American coast, and 90% of the population dies. We don't know that some estimates are that high, and it probably was one sailor. But basically, you have, and there are lots of other examples of that. So So the argument then is that when a population that lives in the city comes in contact with a dispersed population, there's likely to be very high mortality for that reason. So the anyway, so that means since the diseases are evolving to not be lethal, evolution isn't trying to make lethal diseases. On the other hand, human beings might be trying to make lethal diseases, and that raises some fairly obvious problems. Comments? Questions? Suppose you wanted to make a lethal disease. All right. Suppose we think about this problem from a sort of practical standpoint, imagining first that you are the ruler of a country that has enemies. All countries have enemies, right? But you have really good biologists. You may not have as good physicists. They got better bombs and tanks and guns, but you got really good biologists. So what are the potentials for biology for warfare? What's the obvious problem?
I'm confused by your question. What do you mean by biology?
So I mean, you've got good biologists, so you can make, so you could probably make tailor-made diseases.
Okay.
What's the obvious problem with a tailor-made
disease? You basically disperse to somebody else to come back and kill you.
Yeah, the way I think about it is there's a reason why muggers use guns and knives instead of hand grenades. Right. So the problem, the obvious problem with using diseases in warfare, with biological warfare in general, is how do you keep it from killing your own people? And what are the solutions for that? What?
One of the
solutions is you vaccinate your population first. And that's got a bit of a problem because doing something on that large a scale, you're going to have to somehow have some cover story so the enemy don't realize what you're doing and steal some of the vaccine. So maybe a little practical, but it does sound like a sensible thing. A better solution, if you had the right disease, would be a disease that takes a month to incubate or something, so you spread the disease and you then vaccinate your people or have a cure or something. But that, again, depends on having it just right.
Not caring is also a pretty good idea.
Not caring?
Fear people die.
Yeah.
Population.
Or alternatively, you can easily enough, you can imagine a variety of ways in which you could have a disease that wouldn't kill a whole lot of your people. So if you imagine, for example, that the disease spreads better in some climates rather than others, and it's one tailored for the enemy's climate and not yours. Or if you imagine a disease to which some ethnic stocks are more vulnerable than others, and, you know, you're wiping out all of those Chinese, and sorry, we may lose a few of good Americans of Chinese ancestry, but if you care enough, unfortunately, you might take that as an acceptable cost. And you can think of other things of that sort. Or you might have a disease which burned itself out. All right, suppose we say, look, we know why diseases usually aren't lethal. All right, we drop this disease in the middle of the enemy population. As it spreads, it mutates and gets selected. The less lethal strains survive better. By the time it reaches us, if we're lucky, keep a finger crossed, it'll only make us sneeze. All right. So you can think of a variety of things of that sort. Now, the other possibility, of course, and is what if you don't care? What if you're not a nation at all? You're a terrorist. And the question then, to which I don't know the answer, is are terrorists really crazy or not? All right. We like to represent enemies in general as nutty. But it's not at all clear to me that it's really true. My favorite, not terrorist, my favorite counterexample to this is Norse. That we think of Vikings as sort of heroic warrior types. And we think of, well, heroic warrior types don't mind dying, right? That's why they're heroic warrior types. It's just us wimpy moderns who mind dying. There is a account in Njalsaga of a famous battle in Ireland, the Battle of Clontarf, which was the battle which basically lost the Norse their foothold in Ireland. And the Norse army is an army organized by the Jarl of the Orkney Islands, a fellow called Sigurth. And Sigurth has a flag, a raven banner. And the people in his army believe that as long as his banner flies, the army will advance. But whoever carries the banner will die. It's sort of neat, because I think of it almost as a metaphor for the fundamental problem of warfare, which is people don't want to die. Right? The fundamental problem of warfare is the conflict between the self-interest of the soldier and of the army. All right. The story I like to tell when I'm teaching economics is you've got a line of, it's 1,000 years ago. You're one of a line of people with spears pointed that way. Big line, thousands of people. Why are you pointed that way? Because there are a bunch of people on horses with spears coming at you. And the question is, what is it rational for you to do? And you say to yourself, well, if we all stand and hold our spears solidly, if we're lucky, we'll break their charge. And some of us will die, but most of us will live. If we run away, horses can run faster than we can. So I should stand. Oops, I made a mistake. I thought of we. The decisions I make are for I. If I run and everybody else stands, since there are thousands of people, my running has almost no effect on the chance of our losing. And if we do lose, at least I'll be ahead. If I stand and everybody else runs, I'm finished. Whatever the other people are going to do, it's in my interest to run. People follow the argument? It's a disturbing argument, right? This is what I refer to as the dark side of rationality. We all run and most of us die. And it's got to be that one of the central problems in real warfare is how you deal with that paradox, how you set things up so that your people won't run away. And there are a bunch of solutions. One of them is proverbial. It's called burning your bridges behind you. All right, you march your army across the bridge, you line them up, you burn the bridge, and you point out to your people there's nowhere to run to. All right? Another solution is you somehow get your people to have motives that are strong enough to make them risk dying. And the classic case of this, have any of you heard of the Theban Immortals? There was a military unit, I don't know if the story is true, but at least this is the standard classical account, of Thebes. The Immortals? I think that's it. I have the title wrong. Anyway, it was a unit made up entirely of pairs of homosexual lovers, no one of which would ever be shamed in the presence of his beloved. They won every battle they fought until the last, when they encountered a Macedonian army commanded by Philip of Macedon and his son Alexander, and they died to a man. That's the story, at least. All right, so that's another solution to the same problem. And we try to do it too. If you try to motivate your people to make the individual soldier feel as though the buddies right around him are people he's willing to die for. See, the modern version of it. Anybody know in modern warfare what the ratio is of bullets fired to people killed? Say World War II, World War I, something like that? Any guesses?
All around.
Total bullets fired to total people killed. I think it's more like 10,000 to 1. Varies with the war, but it's enormously high. At one point, I knew the numbers. It's been a while. You're in a foxhole, all right? What you're supposed to do is to lift up your head and look around carefully and shoot somebody. This is a very dangerous thing to do, right? On the other hand, if you go bang, 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 with luck, that makes the other side keep their head down, and your officer who's three foxholes down doesn't know the difference. So it's the same problem. It's the problem of the conflict between the rational self-interest of the individual soldier who wants his army to win but very much wants to survive the battle, and the self and what it would be in the interest of the whole army for everybody to do. Right. So that sort of is a very general problem. And I was going to let me get back to Sigurd, because as long as the banner flies, the army advances, whoever carries it dies. Army advances, banner carrier dies. Someone else takes up the banner. Army advances, banner carrier dies. Sigurd turns to one and says, take the banner. Guy steps forward. His buddy next to him grabs him and says, don't touch that thing, it's death. Guy steps back. Sigurd can't find the third person to carry the banner. He says, it is fitting the beggar should bear the bag, cuts the banner off the staff, wraps it around his waist, and leads his army. Army advances, Sigurd dies, nobody takes the banner off. All right, I take that as a sort of quintessential example of the fundamental problem of warfare, that if you've got lots of people who are willing to die, you can win the battle, but people are very reluctant to die, and that results in losing the battle. Well, the Norse are supposed to be these, you know, heroic types. I'm not entirely sure that Al-Qaeda is more heroic than they are. So the worry about terrorists in biowarfare is they don't really care, they just want to destroy the world, and therefore, maybe it's true, but my suspicion is that if you actually look at what they're doing, they are probably rational people who have a set of objectives inconsistent with ours, and they probably do not include getting themselves dead, because most people don't. Maybe a few of them are willing to, but not getting everybody dead. Anyway, so that's other comments on biological warfare. Other questions? Yeah.
No, going back to what you were asking, how would you basically design your biological warfare? I was thinking about that. Well, maybe you want something that spreads very quickly within a population center, and it's going to hit everybody, but it simply incapacitates them somehow, either paralysis, or a coma, or something
right.
like that. And then your you army who's been vaccinated can march in and find the friendlies and lock up the bad people and then right. Give them the antidote.
Yes, another version of this, of course, would be that you have something which kills people quite slowly, and you first spread it to the enemy population, then you offer to give them the cure at a price, and the price is their surrender. Let me think about other things that are worth talking about, since I haven't gotten you people to do enough of the talking tonight for some reason. Everybody's tired and sleepy, as am I. Let me talk a bit about genetic testing, which I mentioned before, because it occurs to me that it actually is closely related to an issue the Supreme Court is about to deal with. Argument on genetic testing, which I think I ran through the basic adverse selection problem at some point, didn't I, last week or not? Yes. So the basic problem is that suppose we've got tests that will tell you how likely you are to have a heart attack or various other serious consequences. And we have a world where these tests are readily available. Insurance companies, not being stupid, say to the customers, if you won't let us test you and see the results, we will charge you a high price for insurance. Because we suspect that you have tested yourself and looked at the results, and the reason you wouldn't let us see the results is you know they're bad, and if you're likely to drop dead of a heart attack, we want to charge you a high price for insurance. All right, make sense so far? People object to that. And they object to it on the ground that before we had the testing, you could insure against having bad genes. That wasn't the way it was put, but you could buy insurance against a heart attack or life insurance against dying, and you would be charged the same amount whether you had good genes or bad genes, because neither you nor the insurance company knew. All right? So if you're in favor of equality, you would say things have just gotten worse. Because now, not only do we have inequality as to how rich your parents were, we have inequality as to how good your genes are, we've always had that, but it now includes the fact that you can't insure against. Going back a step, from an economist's standpoint, the argument for income redistribution is that money is worth more to poor people than rich people. All right, so that seems sort of an intuitive kind of argument, that we say if we take $1,000 from Buffett and give it to a guy who's barely making it, on net, human happiness increases. Seems a very plausible argument. And an economist says, but wait a minute, we have a mechanism for dealing with that called insurance. Because what's insurance doing? Insurance is taking money from me when my house doesn't burn down, giving it to me when my house does burn down. Because when my house burns down, I'm much poorer, and therefore money's worth more to me. All right? Does that make sense as a way of thinking about insurance? Well, so why not insure against being born poor? Ah, because by the time you've gotten born and are in a position to buy insurance, the dice have already been rolled, and therefore you can't take bets on it. Make sense? And what does genetic testing do? It moves that same situation for genes as well. So the response, the obvious response you will make is make a law. Let's say the insurance company is not allowed to condition the price of insurance whether or not you've been tested, or isn't even allowed to have testing. Now the problem is adverse selection, because now what happens is that the people with good genes get tested, they're charged the same amount for insurance as people with bad genes, and in fact the insurance companies correctly suspect that the people most likely to buy insurance are the ones whose genes tell them they're going to need it. They price insurance accordingly. Insurance is now a really bad deal if you've got good genes, so you don't buy it. So now, instead of saying that having bad genes is uninsurable, you say dying is uninsurable unless you have bad genes. If you have bad genes, you can buy insurance at a bad gene price. If you have good genes, you can only buy insurance at a bad gene price, and that's a lousy deal, so you can't insure against the non-genetic risks. That's the basic argument. Now, we've got to qualify this by the fact that all of this argument assumes that genetic testing, in fact, tells you very, gives you very much information relevant to insurance. Probably at this point it doesn't. My guess, having done the experiment, having gotten my genes tested and seeing what they can tell me, is I don't think anything they told me would have changed my insurance rates by more than a few percent. And I actually did the calculation. I had a blog post in which I ran through that, some stuff of that, for at least for my particular case. So as long as the effect is small, it doesn't really matter very much either way, aside from a few people who have really bad genes. But if you imagine that only one person in 10,000 has bad enough genes so that it's really very likely to drop dead, then if you don't allow the insurance companies to check the genes, that person is in effect getting a free ride, but it's not a very expensive free ride because there's so few such people. Make sense? What's the case where exactly the same argument suddenly becomes much more important? Real world case, which part of which is about to go before the Supreme Court. Who are the people who really know they're a bad risk?
Pre-existing conditions.
Right. That if you in fact know that you've had a heart attack, or you know that you have some medical condition for which there's no permanent cure, now you know that you have more reason to buy life insurance for your family than other people do. You know that if you can get health insurance at a reasonable price, it might be, depending on the nature of your problem, it might be a really good deal. We're now faced with adverse selection. All right, makes sense? So, not a problem 5 years ago. Why is it not a problem 5 years ago? Because the insurance company says, before we write you insurance, we'd like some information about you. What are your previous health history? Can we talk, check your doctor's records and so forth? History's clean? Great, we'll insure you at a reasonable price. You've had two heart attacks? Well, you know we can insure you, but it won't be cheap. All right. So that meant that under that situation, pre-existing conditions were not insured. Well, we now have legal rules which are designed to keep insurance companies from charging different prices to people with pre-existing conditions. And there are two arguments that can be offered for those legal rules. One of them is, as before, that we're in favor of equality. Why should having the bad luck to have had two heart attacks result in your medical costs being higher? So that one can think of it as a way of, in effect, forcing the healthy people to subsidize the unhealthy people, and thus causing somehow a more equal or just world according to your particular ideas of equality and justice. The problem is that put in that form, it doesn't work because of adverse selection. Because the pre-existing conditions are a large effect, consequently. Indeed, what do you do? Let us suppose that you don't have a pre-existing condition right now. And you live in a world where insurance companies have to sell you insurance at the same price whether or not you have a pre-existing condition. What's the obvious thing to do? Wait until you get sick. If you don't get sick, you never buy insurance. You save a lot of money. If you do get sick, you buy insurance there at the same price that you'd bought it before, and you're now covered. All right? So that means that forbidding insurance companies to condition the price of insurance on pre-existing conditions means that insurance disappears, in effect. It's no longer really insurance if you only buy it after you get sick, or it's insurance in only a very limited sense. What's the obvious solution? The mandate, of course. So that the argument is that if you insist on forbidding insurance companies from making conditional on pre-existing conditions, then you have to require healthy people to get insurance. So that's why it's occurred to me that I'm talking about it in the genetic testing case, but really the logic of the problem is the same here. Now, the other alternative, of course, is that you allow the insurance companies to do it. Now, I should say, the other argument against the pre-existing condition thing is the claim, and I have no idea if it's true, that insurance companies cheat. The claim is that what the insurance company does is it insures you. If you get sick, it then finds an excuse to claim that you had a pre-existing condition you didn't tell them about, and then therefore it cancels your insurance. I am sure this has happened at least once. Everything has happened at least once. My guess is that it is not routine policy, but I don't really know. But if it is routine policy, you presumably could find ways of preventing it less extreme than saying that you can't make the price of insurance conditional on pre-existing conditions. You could have some explicit definition of what you might tell them and when they can cancel and so forth. And it's not something I've looked into in much detail. But anyway, it just seemed to me that this was a case in which our far future stuff had just run into the present and that it was therefore worth discussing it. Ha, saved it. Other things worth talking about. I was sort of thinking that I wasn't sure if we'd have enough to cover from this chapter, so there were some things that I think I mentioned briefly before, but I thought would be worth exploring. One of them is paternity testing, which, as I've said before, I think of as the stealth reproductive technology, because it's one that's now fully developed and that potentially has a lot of effects. And the most immediate effect at the moment, as I think I may have also mentioned, is the issue of child support. All right, so you possibly are married, possibly you're just living with a woman, she gets pregnant, she has a child. If you're married, you get unhappy and you get divorced. If not, you just break up the way people do from time to time. And then genetic testing demonstrates that you're not the father. Are you responsible for child support? And there's an obvious conflict of interest between the state welfare bureaucracy, which wants somebody other than them to pay for the kid, and the putative father who doesn't, and at least many people's moral intuitions say he shouldn't have to pay, it's not his kid. We can solve this problem. Suppose we accept the view that the non-genetic father shouldn't pay, and suppose we accept the view that the genetic father should pay. All right? How do we solve this conundrum? How could we solve it? With existing technology. That's right. You database every male in the country. And now, whenever... existing technology is probably unfair. We probably aren't good enough yet to identify out of 150 million, only the adult males, 130 million people, the father of a particular child. But we'll be able to in a while. So, in principle, you could have a system where you've got a sufficient database so that every time a child is born, we can prove who the father was. Father is then liable for child support, just as under the standard rules. This is a good idea. What do you think? Yes, no, maybe?
That would be focused on U.S. only. So there will be many cases where...
That's true. Not many cases, some cases. Sure. Right. But, yeah, nothing's perfect. What do people think? Is that a good idea or a bad idea? What's intriguing me, in a way, is that it's a problem created by the technology and solved by the technology, and I always like things like that. I sort of love it. There's apparently a folk belief that nature does this. The folk belief is that if there's a poisonous plant, somewhere growing near it is the antidote. And I don't think there's any reason to believe it's true, but it makes a good story. And it strikes me as having a pleasing symmetry. So this is my technological version of that story. So people think we should or shouldn't do that. Yeah?
I have a thought. I'm not saying it's a good or a bad idea, but it seems like that might have a chilling effect on how many children that some people want to father. It's going to cost me more to have more kids. So,
is that a good effect or a bad effect?
See, I'm going to be neutral with that because...
I want to claim it's a good effect because, after all, if having a kid imposes the cost, you should only take the risk of doing it if you're willing to bear that cost, right? It's like a good sort of general rule. Now, you might say, but we need more children for our army or more children. If you're in Italy or in France, you would say, look, our population is vanishing due to too low a birth rate, so we can't afford this. Any other problem anybody sees? I see one other problem, and that is that it's going to make sperm donation a whole lot harder. All right, you have a sperm bank right now, and at this point, the sperm bank can, if it chooses, believably guarantee that the donor won't end up with a paternity case against him. All right, you can have a legal rule, of course, which says in the case of sperm donation, you're not responsible for child support, which I think is what the legal situation is at the moment, but that can always get changed, right? So, at the moment, there is something better than a legal rule, namely that the sperm bank burns its records. All right, the sperm bank does not keep records sufficiently good to identify the donor. I don't know if they actually use it or not, but they could at least choose not to do it. And if people were worried, they presumably would. So, on the whole, my feeling is the existence of sperm banks is a good thing. Because what does it do? It means that women who want to have a child and either don't have a mate or have a mate who is infertile for some reason have the option not just of having a child, which they can do pretty easily given the willingness of men to have sex with women, but they can have a child by a selected father, selected for characters they like. It's not as good as genetic engineering, but it's as close as we can come at the moment. So they can look at the list and say, well, you know, this father, you know, graduated from a good university, he's got an IQ of 140, he has not turned out with any serious medical defects, not perfect, better than average, so I'll have this one. And that's going to be harder to do in the world I've just described, because there will be no way in which you can write a binding guarantee to the donor that he won't end up having failure. Maybe you can import sperm from foreign countries, maybe that will be the solution along the line that was already pointed out, so maybe that solves it. Anybody else have ideas, suggestions, things on that? No. Let me pick up then on a different, to me, sort of interesting question, which is one I think I also mentioned briefly, and one which I got out of a student paper a few years ago. And that's the issue of ambiguous gender. All right? That we are all used to taking it for granted that every human being is male or female. And even that we know which, with rare exceptions. And that's changed in several different ways. One of them is just that we know more. People always knew that there were hermaphrodites. That's sort of the one fairly rare exception. But putting that aside, we now know two or maybe probably three other things that people didn't know. One of them is that gender ultimately comes down to a particular set of chromosomes, and that some people don't fit either pattern. That is to say, the normal female pattern is XX, the normal male pattern is XY, but there are a small percentage but sizable number of people who are neither of those, who are XXY or any of several other, I think maybe, is there an XYY? I'm not sure. And it turns out that these people are different in ways related to gender. That I think there's one of them who are referred to as hypermasculine, and the claim, at least, is that they're more aggressive, and that's various other masculine characteristics. The XXYs mostly look male, may or may not be fertile, and in some ways are less male physically. There are also, I gather, a few people who are XX or XY but have the wrong body. That is to say that what actually determines what kinds of genitals you have is not directly the genes, but things the genes do to the development of your body, and apparently there are ways in which those very occasionally go wrong, so that you will have an XX who is apparently male or an XY who is apparently female. So we know about those things, and those things introduce some ambiguity in our classification system. And then the additional thing, which I think including, because I believe it is true, although it's less unambiguously true, is that there are some people who are mentally one gender and physically the other. That is, the kind of people who end up wanting to have sex change operations are people who, by their own account, in your head, you're female, even though you are stuck in a male body or vice versa. And not only do we now have pretty good reason to believe that exists, I say pretty good because it's another person's narration of what's inside his head, which I can't observe, but it seems to me unlikely that people would all sort of tell this sort of crazy story if it wasn't true. But we also have people now whose bodies have been surgically altered to get them to at least a facsimile of what they think they really are. So the question then is, how do all of these ambiguities play out in terms of the real world? And that, it seems to me, is really one specific question and one general question. And one set of specific questions, I can give you a list. Who can marry whom? That stops being a problem if you have same-sex marriage, but at the moment in lots of places you don't have same-sex marriage. So if you are not unambiguously either male or female, who do you get to legally marry? All right, so that's one problem. That's been litigated, I should say, as I think I mentioned in the chapter that you haven't read because I didn't design it. There was a case in one of the southern states. It was an inheritance case. You had somebody who, if I've got it correctly, had had a sex change operation, male to female, got married, husband eventually dies, husband's children sue for the estate on the grounds that it wasn't a valid marriage because it was a man, not a woman, and therefore couldn't be married under the laws of that state, and won. And that is one case where you can see, given that the laws only allow MF marriages, that it legally matters whether you're male or female, and then what defines whether you're male or female. All right, not at all clear. Nobody's going to plausibly argue that it's whether you can have babies one way or the other because they're infertile. You know, no one's going to say that the normal 70-year-old woman is not a woman anymore, legally speaking. And yet she almost certainly can't have babies. Well before 70, in fact. How about for one which is partly legal and partly social? Who gets to go into the ladies' room? All right. It happens that I know someone who is XXY. And furthermore, this is somebody who, as best I can tell, thinks of herself as female and looks male. All right. Now, it's possible that she will at some future time alter that surgically. I don't know. It hasn't happened yet. Does he, she get to go into the ladies' room? Do you get to scream when you see her? All right. That's a real possible problem. All right. Consider another one, which I know more or less serious, namely sports. All right, we currently have, in lots of contexts, women's tennis, men's tennis, and various other things. Given that we have that, it matters which you classify as. Well, let us suppose that, let me suppose we've got somebody who is genetically XX and has a male body, which I gather is possible if unlikely. And suppose it's a very athletic male body. Did they actually determine there was a controversy over this? And what was the conclusion? Do you know?
I don't, but it seemed just quite obvious when I saw, just looking, that she was an XXY.
She was an XXY, you think?
Yeah, I mean, I can do like an internet search or like that.
You might check. I remember seeing some stories, but I think at the point I saw it, it was that you had a female sports star who people were arguing was not female, but I don't remember what the evidence was or whether they actually got to do genetic testing or not. Because most XXYs look male. But in any case, you can see that that could be a real issue. And I've seen it asserted, I think, about maybe shot putters. I remember there was something in the Olympics where the claim was that the stars from one of the Eastern European countries were of the wrong gender, and it wasn't clear what was really going on. But that was at least an argument being made. And, of course, we know that even within the ordinary range, there are some women you think of as look sort of mannish and some men you think of as look sort of feminine. And some of that might be style, but some of that's real. Because we know, for example, that there are markers that reflect the mix of hormones in the womb you were incubated in. I think I discussed that before, the finger length marker. And therefore, you might have a male who was incubated in a womb that had a hormone mix closer to what was typical of wombs with females in it than most, and as a result had some feminine characteristics. That's at least a possible situation. So, and as long as we say, yes, but there's an unambiguous male-female, we say, well, all right, maybe a woman who's mannish will do better at tennis than one who isn't. I don't know if that's the case or not, but it could be the case. That's all right. That's within the normal range. After all, a man who happens to be 6'9" will do better at basketball than I will. So that's acceptable, too, and that's an innate difference. But then, as we blur the lines, as if there becomes more and clearer that they're intermediate cases, gets harder. Let us know what the result is of your search. You've got 7 minutes. but we're all experts at this nowadays. And a good thing, too. How about hermaphrodites? That's the old one.
She is a hermaphrodite.
She is a hermaphrodite?
Yeah, that's what the report
is. And do they have genetic?
She has no ovaries. I think it said no uterus, large amounts of testosterone. I'm trying to find a valid source here.
Right.
NBC News.
Yeah, ma'am.
So at this point,
tell me if you find out what the genetics are.
Genetically,
don't know. That's possible too.
No uterus.
Yes.
I haven't found anything that signifies that she also has female sex organs. So.
Don't know. Yep. Could have external and not internal, right?
Yes. Maybe it was just arbitrary miscategorization.
Yep. But what? How about hermaphrodites? I think I mentioned the fact that that's actually covered in Jewish law a while ago, because I had come across that in the context of my other seminar on legal systems, very different from ours. So, you have a baby who's a hermaphrodite. What do you do?
What are they genetically?
That's one interesting question. Typically, I think could be either. My impression of what's going on with the usual hermaphrodite, there may be ones who are genetically odd, but I think the normal pattern is it's genetically XX or XY, and it's just that something, presumed, my guess is having to do with hormones in the womb, but it could be something else, I don't know enough about it, has resulted in the development of at least some male and some female genitalia. And my guess is that in most cases, it's not... It doesn't look quite like either, but there may be cases which really look like both. What do you do with that baby? I mean, there are three options, right? You surgically make it male, you surgically make it female, or you leave it the way it is. What's the right answer?
Case by case.
How would you decide? Then one answer could be that you test genetically. And if it's XX, you surgically make it female. And if it's XY, you surgically make it male. That would be one. That's one possible answer. And maybe that's the best answer you've got if you say, look, my guess is that if it's XX, it's also got a female personality, head, whatever it is that makes you think you're female. If it's XY, it's going to think it's male. We might as well give it a body to fit. So maybe that's the right answer to the question. I don't know. Yep.
What's wrong with letting the baby choose? I mean,
babies don't do much choosing.
Well, yeah, but I mean, letting it obviously grow to it. I mean, obviously, the idea of surgery because of conscious is going to seem.
So that's a third possibility. That's a fourth possibility, really a version of the third, is you do nothing and you assume that it can be surgically changed at some later point. And then you just have to decide when is the child old enough to make up its own mind. And my guess is that at least some parents would be uncomfortable with that because they would say that both they and other kids who might find out about this will be uncomfortable with a child who sort of is icky, doesn't fit, you know, it's neither a boy or a girl, what is that thing, kind of thing. So you can see that as a problem, but you can also see the argument for your position, which is it ought to be the kid's choice and not somebody else's.
Well, I think given the fact that, as you said, I think it's been documented enough that people mentally think that they're another sex, and whether that's also tied to genetic hormones.
We don't know. You're right.
We don't know. And so if you make that, say you make the decision that
could be wrong.
It is an XX, and you know, it's probably going to be a girl, and then it grows up with the mind of a male, then that's...
Have I mentioned the famous fraudulent experiment or fraudulently reported experiment on these? There was a case quite a long time ago where a baby boy... essentially, as far as I know, had his penis cut off as a botched circumcision. Something went wrong. Somebody made a mistake. And a psychologist persuaded the parents, a psychologist who strongly believed that male-female behavior was entirely environmental, not innate, persuaded the parents to have the child essentially surgically altered to be an apparent female, told that he was a she, and brought up as a she. The psychologist in question carefully made sure that nobody else in the world knew who this person was and then wrote reports on it, asserting that it had confirmed the belief that it was purely environmental, that the child was being raised as a girl, and so forth. In fact, somebody eventually tracked down the person, and it turned out the child refused to consider himself a girl, thought of himself as a boy, eventually was told at some point what the truth was, and then switched to presenting as male. So that was sort of a rather ugly story of, as far as I know, nobody ever hanged the psychologist, but it seems a pity. But in any case, but that was one case which again gives evidence that in the normal case, at least, which you think you are, is determined by the genes, even if there are some abnormal cases there. Other cases where the same issue is going to arise, prisons, we often imprison males and females separately. Schools, there are some schools that are all girls or all boys. If you have an all-girls school, can a transsexual, for example, sue to be let in? Well, maybe the answer is they can decide to let in, but maybe it isn't. Depends on what your discrimination rules are in the polity in question. The final question, though, is the general question, which is, are there good reasons why laws or social institutions care about gender? All right? Because if you go back to the marriage issue, a lot of people would argue pretty plausibly no. A lot of people would say, well, look, it makes sense to have this sort of form contract we call marriage, but there's no particular reason why it should be limited to male-female. It's true that it evolved in a context where it was associated with having babies, but after all, same-sex couples can adopt, female-female couples, one of them can bear a child, and we allow people who aren't going to have children to get married too, so therefore. And that's, I don't have strong opinions. My real view is the government shouldn't decide what is or isn't marriage anyway, but I don't. It seems to me that the argument for same-sex marriage is a pretty strong argument on the whole. Less clear to me when you say same-sex restrooms ought to be required, or when you say that it shouldn't be allowed to have a school that's girls only or boys only, or sports. Right? Maybe the answer is that why do we discriminate against men who want to enter the women's tennis thing? Any opinions? Are there good reasons why the legal system in particular, but also other things, have to have gender classifications? Yep.
I've never received one.
They don't anymore.
Okay.
And well, I presume, though I am not certain, that if they ever revive the draft, you're at risk.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say if they did revive the draft and they were still going on.
But the question is, should they? The question I'm asking, which is the interesting question that all of this suggests, is are there good reasons why a legal system should care whether you're male or female? There are certainly good reasons why people should care, right? If I marry another man, we can't have babies, and that's important. And besides, men don't turn me on, and women do. But is there a reason why the legal system should? Try to imagine for a moment a legal system where that category just doesn't exist. And think, we're running out of time, but I think it's an interesting exercise to think about what issues would or wouldn't arise in that. Heinlein somewhere has a sort of a throwaway line in some future society where California has become an independent state, maybe independent country, and is a very sort of progressive kind of country, and they don't in fact have separate men's and women's room, and the way somebody expresses it is setters and pointers use the same fire hydrant.
Prisons would probably be a pretty interesting place.
Well, why is that a problem? After all, you might have a rule which says that you can't put in one cell. Well, you have some way. That's an interesting question because you have cellmates. Well, but if the law doesn't recognize gender, then you can't even do that. And so the question is, maybe the law recognizes sexual preference instead of gender if you could somehow notice it and only allows people with the same preference to be together or something. I don't know.
Probably raise religious considerations too in terms of people that separate themselves based on gender.
Yes. Although I don't know to what extent do prisons really take seriously prisoners' religious restrictions? Pretty much. They don't, for example, when they have a gypsy prisoner, as far as they know, they don't try to follow the gypsy rules of pollution, which I like to describe as Orthodox Judaism on steroids, which would be very hard to do, and it doesn't affect their religion, although it's not put in the form of religious form. But yeah, so that would be could be one place where it would be a problem. But then, of course, if that's what you're doing, it's all right, because you say the relevant category is not male and female. The relevant category is somebody who Catholics consider male versus someone who Catholics consider female, and we don't have to decide whatever the religion is. I think Catholics is an example. All right, I will leave it to you to think about, because if we're thinking about worlds that change, in some of these things, the world has changed an awful lot in my life. Do you know what a parietal rule is? Anybody study ancient history?
Parietal
rule. Something that essentially every college in the country had when I was a college student. The parietal rule was the rule saying what hours men could have women visiting in their dorms, or presumably women have men visiting in their dorms. If you think about how colleges now arrange things, that seems bizarre that that was perfectly normal arrangements. What?
I went to a summer school.
They had such rules.
Yeah, boarding school. Phillips Exeter.
Uh huh.
Yeah, they had that. I mean, but that's.
Minors.
That's high school.
That's right. Yeah, we haven't quite gotten to the point where high schools take it for granted that students are living together, right?
I'm sure you're not that yet. But you still have bridge.
Oh, do we still have to?
Yeah.
Still have to? I don't know.
If you want to receive financially.
So legally speaking, they still have registration even though they don't have
the
registration.
Yeah, I mean, you should apply under the radar, but if you want to.
Legally speaking, they do.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So that is a difference. But anyway, my guess, maybe I'm wrong, but my guess is that if they reinstituted the draft, they draft women. I may be wrong. But
yeah.
Certainly somebody thinks that they didn't, and whether they'd win is hard.